Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. We're glad to have you with us. And if you are with us live, I'd like to go ahead and extend the usual altar call. You can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room while we're live. We've already got Lee in there. He's already got his feathers all ruffled. So that is a great place during the course of the next hour where if you have some topics you would like for us to discuss, we're always looking for great ideas to talk about. We already have bounced a few things around in the pre-show for today's Melee format, which is also exciting. If you're with us live, you can look up at the top of the show page. That's where you will see the studio line. If you wanted to call into the switchboard and give us what for, or basically ask us a topic you would like for us to chat about, we are more than likely to want to do that. So welcome to the summer doldrums. Kick back, relax, and try not to sweat too much as I sit under the air conditioning. Eagle One, happy Sunday to you.
Well, thank you, Sal, and back to you.
Well, thank you very much. I guess one of the things we can kind of kick off, because you are an illustrious U.S. Naval Reserve captain retired, is there was a fair bit of a, right after the NATO summit, the White House just innocently put on auto transmit, I think, a little announcement recalling or getting the authorization, if so desired, to recall 3,000 reservists. And it, I think what got everybody is excited is they used the formula out of U.S. code and said, of which only, I believe it was 450 could be individual ready reserve per service, basically, and I think they called it Atlantic Resolve, which is supporting the buildup and distribution of not forces, but funds and equipment to the Ukrainians. And that got everybody a little bit excited, but I think what we probably have here is somebody in the PR and the paperwork shop, from what I've been able to gather from chatting with a few people, this isn't something anybody should really, quote, worry about, or it's an indicator of something larger. It was just a bureaucracy pushing something out it needed to push out without thinking about the larger context and timing and how that messaging would go. It was some awkward timing, but it might be a good, you are a resident expert, at least on how the Naval Reserve operates. For the listeners that might not be as familiar with it, you know, what is that difference as far as recalling goes between a cell res and an IRR, and how, at least on the Navy side of the house, you might get pulled in to do things that aren't quite Navy-like.
Yeah, independent, the IRR is the individual ready reserve. There are people who probably have completed their mandatory or obligated service, both active and reserve. I think many of us had to spend at least 4 years on active and X number of years, 4 or so years in reserves before we were completely free of a reserve obligation if we went that route. So you can end up with weird situations where these you know, they're supposed to call them once or twice or every now and then and inspect them and make sure they have their full sea bag and all that stuff. But they are people who are not getting paid. They're just members of the Naval Reserve that are kind of off on their own. And every now and then something comes up where some of them will volunteer or get called up for something. The Select Reserve are paid folks. Those are the folks that when they go in for 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year, and they get paid for their time, and they accrue retirement points, which is a different system than the active have, because you get if you drill once a month, you get 4 points for each drill weekend, and you get for 2 weeks you get 14 points. Anyway, that figures out as all those points add up for your retirement package, and at some point you have enough where you can retire if you spend 20 years or whatever, and whatever your rank is and all, you get the number of points you have is divided by the number of possible days in a year, by the number of years you served, or some magic formula, and they come up with a number that will be what percentage of active duty pay at your pay grade you will get, and that's how your retirement is calculated. The IRR doesn't get any money, so they're not, unless they're called active duty. And if they're called active duty, I guess they get points for every day they spend on active duty. At least that's how the Navy Reserve works. I'm not quite sure about what the other services have, but I think it's pretty similar.
Almost need a spreadsheet with embedded if-then statements and differential equations to figure out what you're doing. And of course, the Army doesn't just have the Army Reserve; they also have the National Guard. Some lifelong friends of mine are in the Air Force Reserve, and their system is very, very. Yes, some interesting career options in the Air Force Reserve. That there's really nothing comparable to it on the Navy side of the house. It's hard to understand. It's not really what we would call full-time support, or for you really graybacks, the old TARs. It's different than that. It's more than that. It's more integrated than that. And of course, the Navy Reserve is its own little world in that regard. But I thought that was an interesting exercise, just to see not just people's reaction. I had a little fun with it. But also, here we are. We like to tell ourselves we're the world's most effective military. We're not the largest, but we are the most effective. We have global reach. We have all these allied systems, systems of allies, and a pretty big active duty force, especially relative to our neighbors. We feel the need that we need to tap a few thousand more people on the shoulder. And my understanding, we've already activated quite a few reserves in the course of the last year and a half. It just hasn't broken above the background noise like this little message from the White House did. But we have to do that in order to make relatively modest logistics happen to another nation's war that we just happen to be supporting. It makes you kind of tilt the head, but you go back to Desert Storm, you go back to, this is personal to you, the Balkan Wars, and of course what we're doing in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Reserves were a big part of that. I know at HQ ISAF when I was there, not just Navy Reserve, but Air Force, Army Reserves were in there really thick, including the oldest Army major I've ever seen in my life. He retired on active duty back in Vietnam, but because he was a civil affairs guy, they gave him a call, and his wife asked him, "Will this mean your retirement pay will be more?" He said, "Yes." So he went back on active duty to go work in Kabul. But I guess, and you were a junior officer when this whole argument took place, is in the period immediately after Vietnam, part of our all-volunteer Navy and the way they structured the reserves at that point was if we were ever going to get involved in a conflict that was not a, quote, war, unquote, full mobilization, that it would hit broadly in our nation for people's family members and neighbors would be called up. I wonder if we've reached the point, though, that since 1991, if it's become so regular that nobody notices anymore. It's just kind of the way we do things.
Yeah, I think, most people don't know. I mean, if you're a cell res, theoretically, you're in a unit or drilling with a unit that if it serves some function that they need, then you'll get called up. So if you're a Navy diver in a mobile diving and salvage reserve unit, then and they need divers, that's a good chance you will get called to active duty. But you're already, you know, that's part of what you're getting that monthly pay for and gaining those retirement points, is they can call on you anytime. It is different when you start digging down into the IRR or even into the volunteer training unit, which is IRR essentially, except you drill. You know, you're not getting paid. You're attending the drills just to get points and maybe to acquire some job that looks good, so that when a pay billet comes available, you'll select for that. So when I was called up for Desert Storm, my reserve unit was an inshore undersea warfare unit. We got called up as a unit, and we went to Saudi Arabia and other places. And then we came home as a unit. So that was a unit activation of selected reserves. I also had in that unit, I had a few active duty people that kept our equipment and the message traffic and stuff while the rest of us were doing our normal civilian jobs. So that's another kind of unit. It was a commissioned unit, and that was a different kind of call-up. Now, if you have some special skill, like there's a friend of mine who is a salvage officer, marine engineer, and he gets, every time we get a ship blown up, like or has a collision, he's the guy who the Navy was calling on to go out and get those ships loaded on those heavy lift ships, because that was a particular area of expertise that he had. So, you know, that he got called up for that and said he would either go as a civilian contractor and get paid big bucks, or they call him up as a Navy commander or captain and he would go get paid lesser bucks. But they could activate him for that kind of work. And what you get on a lot of these things, you get called to active duty. I got called active duty for the Kosovo thing, but I was supposed to do one mission, and of course there's a bait and switch thing. You get there, well, the mission we called you up for doesn't exist anymore, but hey, you've got this skill set, so why don't you do this for a while? And, you know, so they've already got you. You're already being paid. I don't think it's coming out of their pocket necessarily, the money that you are getting. So, you know, they're happy to keep you as long as you're willing to stay. And there's something for you to do that's meaningful. So, you know, and that is also a lot of CELRES and maybe some IRR guys, I don't know, got called up or volunteered to go to Afghanistan and other places during that period, the Afghan-Iraqi war, and they got assigned, kind of like some of you active duty folks got assigned to be take the job that should have been held by Army or Air Force personnel at either commands or headquarters units for the most part, unless, you know, of course, you're some reserve SEAL, then that would probably get you into a different kind of unit if you got shipped overseas. So we know, you and I both know, that people who got sent on some of those jobs, and, you know, depending on your level of expertise and what they wanted you for, you could end up being... And here, I think we're talking about an Army guy, oldest Army officer, or wherever he was that you'd ever seen. You know, if they want you and you're 64 or 65 years old, they'll take you. I mean, we had a doctor who would in one of our medical units who was at least 67, and you know, he just kept going, and he was like Energizer Bunny. They just kept calling him up because he had a special level of expertise.
Yeah, it's one of those things that if you're in good physical shape and you're willing to serve. I know one story that I remember from early on in the Iraq War, I think I wrote something about it in 07 or 08. It was a guy who was, he was an orthopedic surgeon. And his son, I believe, was killed in Iraq. And he volunteered to go over there to be a doctor. Yeah, and he was in his 60s. And, you know, he went to knife and fork school, and he was over there because of the injuries that were taking place. You couldn't get enough orthopedic guys. You couldn't get too many of them. And that was kind of how he worked through his own grief. So it's always interesting when the balloon goes up. I remember joking to my very, very patient and understanding spouse about this. She kind of raised an eyebrow. I was like, oh no, I'm still a kid. I'm still in my, I keep wanting to say mid 50s, but I think I'm going to border to late 50s, but I'm still a kid. I was like, oh no. If them to pull me up, we have larger problems than me being activated. I think I'm pretty safe. I'm retired. I just talked to a friend of mine who just retired from the Naval Reserve as well. And he's like, they're not getting me. If they come grab me, we're in big trouble. So, yeah, I don't. It's one of those things that when they do activate the reserves, I sent a note to somebody who was a little excited about it. I was like, no, if you're pulling CELRES and IRR people, these are not people's teenage kids or college age kids. These are people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s that are getting tapped on the shoulder. It's, you know, the military is the geriatric brigade going forward. So to fill billets, they're not a bunch of 20-year-olds being pulled up.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And but, you know, if you've got some, like, I knew a guy who was a forensic dentist. You know, he got called up a lot because every time there was a plane crash, they needed somebody to identify people through their teeth because that was all that was left. They'd call him up. So I never even heard of a forensic dentist.
It sounds like a joke, but it's true. I always tell people, be very careful what is in your record about your subspecialty codes. Like one of the last conversations I had before my detailer, before I left active duty, is one of my subspecialty codes was financial management because of my academic background. And basically he was trying to sell me on the fact that I could go into an innate job, the finance part, some job where there have some shortages. I'm like, if you're trying to encourage me to continue with retiring, you're doing pretty well here. But I could, you know, in the reserves, because you are not just reserves, in the military in general, you are a number. And if there's a demand for, you know, 7245s, they'll do their little get into their Unix machine over in Millington that's been around since the Korean War. And it'll spit out everybody who has those four numbers. And if you're on that list, you're going to get a call. So be careful what subspecialty codes you have in there, because it can, especially if you leave active duty and go into the reserves, you can return to active duty faster than you think.
Yeah, when I was over in Italy for the Kosovo thing, they suggested that because I was a lawyer that maybe I would want to help the JAG people. I respectfully declined. So
yeah, we're gonna do a night insertion via Hilo to Sarajevo. That's one of those things where you walk up and you go, excuse me, I'm in the Navy. There's no water here. Can I go back to the boat, please? It's like, oh, no, you're a lawyer.
We have ways of making you work.
it's funny because lawyers are kind of like doctors in this regard. You know, if you're having heart problems, you don't go to your dermatologist. If you have, you know, if you're having problems with your estate, you don't need some probate work done. You don't go to somebody who's a public defender or a slip fall lawyer. People have their different specialties, but it's like, oh, you're a lawyer. Come here and help us with the war crimes. No, I'm a business guy. Do you have a contract I can look at? Yeah, it's a little different.
And that's basically what I told them was I don't think the skill set that I acquired as a lawyer for big oil companies was particularly useful in what they were doing. So.
Oh, man. Hey, another thing we could probably go for reserves all day. Remember, I tried to get a guest of ours to come on just to talk about reserve issues, but I think he's doing like everybody else is doing this summer and going on vacation. But there's something I think that we could do three episodes on, but something that you mentioned in the pre-show that I also wanted to dive into is you learn something new every day. I never heard of, though I should have, Laconia Shoals. Outline for the listener what the Laconia Shoals are and why they should go to Wikipedia and start reading up.
Yeah, the Laconia Shoals are kind of the lower end of the Spratly Islands, which the Spratly Islands, if you're looking for them on a map, are near Palawan, part of Philippines, kind of north of Brunei, north of the part of Malaysia that Brunei sits in the middle of on that. And they're southeast of Vietnam. So there's the Spratlys, there's a whole bunch of islands in that area, and then there's this Laconia Shoals. And it happens to lie within the 9-dash line of the Chinese. So the Chinese have been really active for years in sending ships to this area and making all kinds of claims because it's in their 9-dash line. Well, if you're the Malaysians, you've got an exclusive economic zone which covers all or part of these islands or shoals, and you're politely telling the Chinese, no, we really don't need your help. Well, the Chinese have been persisting, and recently there was a new entity from Stanford University. It's called SeaLight.live, and it talks about the maritime gray zone. I'll put a link up here to this. Let me copy that. So anyway, they talk about the gray area activities of the Chinese. And today on Twitter, the head of this organization put out a tweet that mentioned that the Chinese had sent a scientific exploration ship down there to check out those shoals, and had been accompanied by a Chinese Coast Guard ship. So, and this is the second time recently, within the last 5 weeks, that this ship has gone down there. So, it is another one of those cases where you watch the Chinese pushing the envelope in many different ways, and this is one of those ways.
Now, I did the thing I always like to do. I immediately went to Google Earth and I did a little search. Where is Laconia relative to the nearest Chinese real land? And it for those that have your globe handy, feel free to Hainan Island, where we for variety of reasons decided we wanted to land one of our most classified aircraft on a quarter century ago. If you go from Hainan Island 164 true at 820 nautical miles, you hit the rough area of Laconia Shoals. Where that is relative, if you were sitting in Miami and you wanted to know what's 820 nautical miles away, it's roughly the distance from Miami to San Juan, the northwest coast of Puerto Rico, which is also the same distance to a lot of the west coast of Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador. So it's kind of – sometimes when I think about the Chinese mindset towards the South China Sea, I think about the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean in the American mind. And those ranges are similar if you go all the way down to Laconia, because 820, if you go directly due south, you tickle – the Colombian border and where Aruba, Curacao, and Bonaire are, except the fact that besides there are some little islands in the west central Caribbean that both U.S. and Colombia claimed, but we just shrug our shoulders and we don't fight with them. Or is it U.S. and Nicaragua? I don't know. U.S. and one country down there, we both have claims to it, though we have never done anything and it's kind of really theirs. But we haven't really stated that this is all ours outside of the little spot that we have in Gitmo and, of course, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands. But nobody questions our ownership. We bought or conquered those fair and square or traded for them. But the interesting thing about the Laconia Shoals is a lot of what Chinese like to claim is these things are always historically ours. And one thing that I do like about Wikipedia, you got to be careful quoting it, but you have to go two layers deep in Wikipedia, and you have to look at the footnotes. And they, under the Wikipedia Laconia Shoals, there's a nice footnote from a 2019 study with this guy who he went through and he looked at the Chinese claims of the South China Sea and what they derive. And he actually talked about the Laconia Shoals. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce it because I still can't pronounce Chairman Xi's name correctly, everybody tells me. But basically, it's a Sinicized, which is the equivalent of Anglicized, version of Laconia from the 1930s. And so they really don't have a claim to it, but that won't stop them from making the claim. It sits in the southeast corner athwart those shipping lanes coming out of the Singapore Straits. And if you go northwest of them, of there, into the Gulf of Thailand off the Cambodian border, there's also the Cambodian naval base there that the Chinese, it's interesting, some of the passive-aggressive stuff on it. Last decade, we gave some money to Cambodia to put some buildings on Ream Naval Base. Well, the Chinese have gone into Ream Naval Base. They've torn those down, and they're basically building a dual-use facility naval base. Now, it's up there in the Gulf of Thailand. Between those two locations, you can see with what they're doing in the South China Sea and reaching further south of there. Because that's that main sea line of communication that doesn't just go to the People's Republic of China, but that's also where Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, all those people, that's their major artery. That I guess that's the equivalent of North America, the coast right off Newfoundland. All that great circle route, all those major convoy routes are all going to go through there. And you don't have to be somebody who played Risk every other weekend in their grade school years to see the importance of geography there. It all kind of makes sense, but, you know, what is the scatterings of Borneo, the Philippines, Indonesia, and a little bit further to west, Malaysia, and you can throw in Singapore and Vietnam, you can kind of see where they're trying to have a united front, but China looks to be in a pretty nice position where what are these little scattered countries going to do about it? And so far, nobody's really, though I think Indonesia has blown up a few Chinese fishing boats, but nobody really has called them on it or even really has the capability to call them on it.
I think people are calling them on it, but you know that doesn't stop the Chinese. So, unless you are willing to engage in physical destruction of somebody that's in your exclusive economic zone, and you know if their claim is that they're exploring, I can't remember exactly what UNCLOS says about the ability to explore anybody else's exclusive economic zone, but you know they're playing this game. It's salami slicing. We're just going to keep nudging. I just put a link up to a map that the CSIS had, and it shows where Laconia Shoals is pretty clearly, right off the coast of Brunei and Malaysia. So. You know, and that was back in 2018, 2019. So this is not a new effort on the Chinese to just work their way slowly, methodically. Time is on their side. Nobody's going to do anything. And, you know, they ignore the international arbitration thing that told them to quit doing stuff to the Philippines and where the Philippines both territorial waters and exclusive economic zone meets other countries in the South China Sea. So, you know, they're scofflaws.
I want to back up a bit because you mentioned it and you put a link in the chat room, but this is a great example for the listeners that I don't care how long you've been soaking in this, is you'll always find out about new resources. And it is a pretty new resource. But you mentioned sea light from the Sanford, I wrote it down somewhere. Yeah, here we go. The Sanford University Gordian Knot Center for National Security. I like that name. You know, where's Alexander with the sword when you need him? But I would encourage the listeners to go into the chat room if you're with us live and kind of look at what's going on there, what they've done recently. And for those who are up on the podcast, I'll put a link on the show page so you can scroll down and find it. But you look over the month of July, China greets Philippine Coast Guard with Armada at the second Thomas Shoal. China's gray zone tactics playbook, swarming. Then they just talk about a couple things. They talk about rafting. They talk about unsafe maneuvers. So it's really, it not only talks about this series of things that China's been doing for a while, but it has it in little, nice little bite-sized pieces, so to speak. It'll be interesting to see if they keep this pace up of topics, but it looks like an interesting resource. I've only done a little skim of it in the last hour or so, but you gave me a good homework assignment this week to look at it because, you know, Stanford University, it's no slack, so you guys are pretty good minds thinking about it.
Yeah, it's a good resource, and, you know, there are a lot of people. CSIS has this, God, what is the name of that thing? They've got their own island tracking thing of what's happening in the South China Sea. So they've jumped on this too. Quite CSIS AMTI, I think it is. It's a project that they've got going. So the good, yeah, it's the, let's see what it is. I just knocked myself off the air.
I still got you.
Okay, Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, and I'll put that on as soon as I get back on the show site.
Well, the audio is still good, regardless of what you. Yeah, occasionally I do that. I try to change from one window to another, and I just delete it. It's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I got too many windows open, is what it amounts to. So I apologize to everybody. All right, I'll be back there in a second.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Well, I'll continue prattling on. But there's, regardless of how much you talk about things and you cover topics, it's sometimes you feel like you're nobody's listening, or maybe you're the only one that really cares. But the more you read, the more you realize there are other people working in parallel paths that are covering similar issues. And, you know, when you look at one of the things that made me smile this week, is, and I know we've talked about it here for over a decade, and I prattle on about it on a regular basis in writing, but it's always kind of bothered me, and in particular for the topic, but it also bothered me that really important people weren't prioritizing the problem. And one of them, of those issues, is the fact that, you know, maybe it's just the way I was raised, but real friends, when you have a common project, they help out to the best that they can. Some people are stronger. Some people are weaker. Some people have more financial capabilities than others, but everybody makes a fair share. You know, if one family can bring a main dish, maybe another family can, you know, bring some mixed fruit or something like that, but everybody tries. And it's never good in any type of relationship to have a free rider, somebody that, you know, expects everybody else to bring the beer to the party, never brings a side dish, just shows up and eats and drinks everybody else's stuff. That just creates resentment and makes it hard to keep a friendship group intact. And alliances are kind of like that. And Meet the Press this weekend, it was kind of nice to see with the whole, our NATO friends need to do their fair share. Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, he came on and kind of called Canada out as an example. And I like what he stated, that of the 31 nations, yes, we now have 31, that are in NATO, there are only 7 that are spending that floor of 2%. Everybody else is not. And Canada just spends 1.29%, which is even less than what Germany spends. And when you see a senator in an environment like that that will bring that topic up, it's encouraging, because we could talk about it all day long and we're not going to move the needle much. But when U.S. senators start bringing that up again, it kind of disappeared when we changed administrations. But I think the larger body politic is still getting leverage on that, which is good, because I also read this week that specifically Germany, that there is a regression to the mean of buying Russian energy and Russian sanctions, and already starting to talk about one to back them up while the war is still going on. So having senators and other senior people keeping up some of the healthy criticism that hopefully will have some effect on a larger alliance, because if it keeps building resentment and you still have free riders, not only does it, I think, weaken the alliance in real terms, and we've seen that in our limited stockpiles we can share, but it also weakens the alliance in that it makes those players who are doing their fair share go into greater conflict with their fellow alliance members who don't appear to be getting off the couch and pushing.
Yeah, you hit me with a number. Somebody hit me with a number that Canada is one of the cheapskate countries. They're like 1.28% or something. It was a really low number.
Yep.
Of what they were. Yeah, so that's not impressive. They're fairly, even though they're not a large country population-wise, they're a fairly wealthy country. They should be chipping in their fair share.
Yeah, they've got a population of, I think, it's roughly 10%, maybe between 10 and 12% of the U.S. population. If they spent at least the 2% of their GDP on defense, that's huge. They're half the size of the U.K. and France, roughly, you know, plus or minus 10%. They're not insignificant, but they are insignificant players. And it goes back a fair bit. If you look at force generation during the First World War, Canada, pretty much they had no officers at all. They just were blended into Commonwealth nations. They fought in the Korean War. They didn't play in the Vietnam War. They were a rounding error during Desert Storm. I don't think they did anything in Iraq of mention, though they did it from a training team point of view. And in the first few years in Afghanistan, they had, you know, they called Kandahar Province Kandahar because the Canadians put in maneuver forces. They even had to borrow some tanks because they just gotten rid of their tanks and decided they need it, so they got some Leopard 1s back. But they moved their maneuver forces out in 2007, which I really don't blame them. They came in there pretty firm for half a decade and expected other alliance members, kind of like the Dutch who left the left Oregon province more or less at the same year. But other alliance members didn't came in, so I don't fault them too much for that. But they used to be quite the powerhouse, but they... between the UK and the US, they figured they just didn't need to invest as much in an alliance member, which is a shame, because if you've worked with Canadians, you know that pound for pound, they're as good, if not better, than the US military, and especially in some specialized areas.
They are active when they do send their people, their military people, to places where military people are needed, and including the NATO efforts in Europe and stuff. But they're tiny, and they spend their money. Given the size of their coastline and what's theoretically going to happen when the Arctic ice melts, they have a huge seacoast, and they're going to need more assets. So they're going to have to pony up, and I don't know what they count toward NATO, because and I've never quite understood is the amount of money that they're attributing them, is that their total defense budget, or is that just the money that NATO gives them credit for? Because they do have a lot of stuff going on with the radar systems and stuff that we still maintain across the northern part of Canada.
Well, this could kind of flow into a topic I know you wanted to talk about, because if the Canadians had a change in government, and wanted to go from 2.9 to 2.75 by 2027, and then by 2030, 2.0 and up. I could think of one great place for them to invest some money, and they need to replace their submarines. Yeah, especially with their Arctic commitments. If the Canadians wanted to join in the AUKUS program with their fellow Commonwealth members, Australia, with the mother country in the UK, that's kind of a – I know there's been some discussions that they'll get more conventional submarines because the Dutch and the Norwegians and the Poles, I think, are working together on a new conventional design. But that's really optimized for the Baltic and the North Sea. Canada has huge maritime requirements, and they do have a good submarine tradition. They're not like the Danes who got rid of theirs. Boy, that would be great if the Canadians wanted to take advantage of this interesting window that's opening up. And they could get some capability now that would have cost them a lot more money should AUKUS have never existed. It'd be interesting to see the business case on that.
Yeah, and maybe they'll jump into it, because I can't remember. They have kind of a checkered history with the submarines they did have. I think kind of like the Australians, that they had these, was it Collins class or something, that turned out to be not all the best possible thing. But
they bought the last of the British conventional submarines from the end of the Cold War, who had insert your anybody who's owned British cars from the 70s and 80s will appreciate this, had a lot of electrical issues. They've had problems with it. They haven't had quality. And before that, they had Oberon class boats, which were good but were just old as dirt.
Yeah, as the owner of two MGs from the 60s and 70s, yes, the electrical problems may have occasionally occurred. anyway. I think that the good news is that AUKUS looks like it's moving forward with the Congress allowing the technology transfer, and also three Australian officers have completed the nuclear power school and are going to be assigned to I assume PAC fleet submarines to learn the trade. Nuclear power trade the way. So that is great. I think it's great news for the Australians, great news for the U.S., and it shows that we're making a serious commitment to make this AUKUS thing work.
Yeah, it really is a natural fit. And Australia is even smaller than Canada, but unlike Canada, they don't have a big neighbor that's friendly to them. I mean, their largest neighbor is Indonesia, who have an iffy history with. And New Zealand to the southeast is even smaller. I think they're, 6 million? I should know how many New Zealanders there are, but they're a very small country. They're like comparable to Norway or Denmark. So they live in a tough neighborhood. They're, besides the U.S., their closest possible ally is Japan, way north of there, but that's not a natural pairing either. So it makes sense that with a China that's intent on expanding, and some of the, for those that have read the Australian press, they had some pretty, and they're still working through it, though from what I've seen, they've made success mostly mitigating it. But before they got religion on China's aims a few years ago, The People's Republic of China had made a very big impact and influence operation in their academia and in their business, because the Australian economy is similar to Russia in the way it's an extraction economy. They have more natural resources than they can do a value-added stuff to locally. So they export a lot of coal, I'm understanding a lot of iron ore, a lot of other type of raw materials to the Chinese. So there's this huge connection economically to China, not unlike what Germany was continuing to develop with Russia. When you have those kind of economic ties where Would you look at New Zealand again? I looked up a couple weeks ago. They signed a free trade agreement with the People's Republic of China in 2008. And since then, their exports have increased eightfold to the point that even if New Zealand wanted to mitigate the amount of economic play and reliance they had on the People's Republic of China, their economy would implode. It would take a long time to, if they can, to bleed them off of that reliance on the People's Republic of China, kind of like the direction Germany was going before the February 2021 invasion. So the economic play and the geography, again, comes into play. And hopefully the Australians won't balk at the significant cost that nuclear submarines do have. But when you look at the requirements of distance and the fact that the UK and the US are some of the best partners they can have in this regard, it really does make sense. And a lot of people are working hard to make the AUKUS program work well. And so far, so good. But we'll see when things start getting displaced. I would assume that those officers going through the U.S. nuke training are probably folks that just got through with their first sea tours, that are probably qualified submariners just going through nuke school. So those are probably the guys that maybe won't be young enough to be the first CO of Australian boats, depending on when they show up, but maybe the Commodores. So it's nice to see them starting to build that cadre that could make it turnkey. Have you seen an update recently in the last few months about what the plan is, whether we're going to transfer Virginia class already under construction to them, or they're just going to have to get in line production schedule on our end? I don't think that's been finalized.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I know we're supposed to start sending subs down there. And to give you an indication of who they sent, two lieutenant commanders and a lieutenant to New Power School. So it's not exactly their most junior folks. But I think they're all wearing some kind of dolphins.
That helps them build the leadership cadre that understands nuke. Those are your future program managers and the folks helping with shipyard and pier design, and will build those personal relationships on the U.S. Side of the house. Be interesting to see when the U.K. comes in. So that sounds right. Sounds smart.
Well, I'm just, I've bashed the current administration on some things, but this AUKUS thing and the way they're making it move is I'm very impressed with that, so.
I don't know how that funding will eventually play out, or what the Brit contribution is. I remember one of the thoughts I had early on is like, are they going to build Astute class submarines? And we talked here a little bit about the very limited flex that we have in our nuclear power and nuclear submarine infrastructure to build. And evidently the British challenge, which would be understandable because of the much smaller size of their force, it's even more tight. So the UK will help where they can, but I haven't, maybe I need to read more British press to see what they've been doing so far, but I don't know how much of that partnership the Brits will actually work around. Maybe some of the weapon systems that our nuclear submarine community doesn't want to share with the Brits, with the Australians or the Brits, that they'll put that in. I don't know how you're going to hide that stuff if we're going to have some of the Aussies riding our boats, but they'll figure it out.
They've got it. They're still going. I think their next step is to go to the nuclear prototype school course, whatever it is in Idaho, and then they're going to go to the basic submarine officer course. So, I'm not quite there. We've got a couple of years, I think, before they hit the fleet. So, but the next step after they do all that stuff will be to put them on a boat somewhere.
Yeah, I think the. They station on the west coast of Australia. That's that's pretty easy access to the huge Indian Ocean there. I think that's where they have their submarines right now. I could be wrong. What is that, Perth? Do I have that right?
Yeah, Perth is on the west coast. I think that's right. There was a – historically, the U.S. had a submarine facility. I think it was north of Perth, but on the west coast. What I've read about it, and this is based on something I read years ago, was that it was kind of a primitive location. It wasn't exactly but you know, we were fighting a war, so maybe that was good enough.
Yeah, I know the Marines rotate in and out of Darwin. Darwin's kind of a ranch town to a certain extent, but Perth, that's a different matter. I don't think they're going to have any much trouble in Millington finding people volunteering to go to whatever facility we wind up having in Perth. That'd be a pretty nice set of orders.
I'd go.
Really? Recall me. And also with that growing partnership that we've had in the Indian Ocean with the Indians, who obviously have similar concerns with a growing China that we all do. Another one of those things that I saw in passing once, but it never really clicked in. But interesting reading is, you know, we do exercises with the Japanese all the time. We do exercise with the Indians. We actually had, you know, multinational exercises. But since 2012, the Japanese and the Indians have been doing bilateral naval exercises. They call it GINEX, J-I-N-E-X, that is really an interesting idea. I would love to see some more detailed write-ups than already seen on how those two navies are interacting. I would assume having worked with the Japanese, they work very similar to we do. That is a mean combination of forces that I don't know how much of a future it has, but it is a way to kind of let China know that we have friends outside of just America, and we are making lots of friends. It was nice to see one really friendly nation and one that's aggressively neutral working together like that, because they do have mutual overlapping interests.
Yeah, and I think it sends a nice Asians working for Asian in Asian cooperation for Asian defense. So I hope it. I hope it blossoms. And India is another one of those countries that has the potential to really go gangbusters if they would turn themselves loose. And to answer Lee's question, I don't know if the Indians are ever going to give up dealing with their Russian equipment. I don't. That maybe that's just part of their effort to be neutral, where they need a number of MiGs and Sukhois, and they give the Russians their hypersonic missile system, the BrahMos missile system. I don't know.
They have decades of relationship with the Russians in that regard. They do get a good deal because I believe the Indians are paying hard cash, and the Indians are one of the few people that's buying Russian fuel in bulk, in volume right now. So again, India, aggressive neutral, but they don't have to be our friends. As long as they're not our enemies, they'll have the habits they have. I can't blame them, because for a lot of those real nasty wars that India fought against Pakistan, you know, we were backing the Pakistanis and giving them lots of weapons. So there are a lot of Indians who are dead on American weapons. And during the Cold War, they were one of the leaders of the non-aligned movement, trying to triangulate. And of course, they're part of the BRICS. But I think the reality of an aggressive China is what's drawing them to be, if nothing else, just a little more friendly and opening to us, which is advantageous for us, because they are now, I think they've finally surpassed the Chinese in population. Their economy is steadily growing. They have challenges, but they are the world's largest democracy. They are more of a natural friend than they are a natural ally. We really don't have any competing interests that oppose us. A lot of historical baggage to work through, and habits to a certain extent. But it's good to have friends like that. And I'll put a link on the show page later. When I take a break, I can't put it in the chat room. But last week, Mackenzie Eaglin had an article out, multiple guests, Mackenzie Eaglin, who I've had the pleasure of meeting in person. Gosh, she's so smart. She's so good. But she really knows the budget real well. And what she looked at is really the operative thing. Everybody who's been looking at refinancing or getting a mortgage now, they know that we're in inflation. Heck, if you go to the grocery store or you try to go to Chick-fil-A, you know inflation is an issue. And she looked at the buying power of our budgets, our military budgets. And even though on paper it looks like it's increasing, with the numbers that she's worked, and she's over at AEI now, is over the next fiscal year, the U.S. military is $90 billion in the hole on buying power because of inflation. So fiscal year 2024, from a buying power point of view, the budget's roughly the same as it is 2020. So our budgets are flat line, if not falling back again, because they're not keeping pace with inflation, and it's probably not going to increase anytime soon. So this network of alliances that we're building, I'm not about to go full Mike Mullen, thousand ship Navy concept or anything, but when you look at the larger trends, are we making more friends than enemies? And are our friends bringing stuff to the table, if not in wartime, at least keeping our potential opponents, their competitors, looking not just over their shoulder at us, looking over at their other shoulder at somebody else. And I think that relationship with India is going to pay dividends in that regard, because if a nation really does have a bone to pick and a border dispute with China that could do some damage, it would be India.
Yeah, I think people tend to forget that China does have a fairly substantial border with China, and they haven't gotten along, and China's killed Indian soldiers, and, you know, it's an ugly, ugly relationship up there on those northern borders. So, you know, I'm sure that's what India's, they would like us to, if not at least on their side, at least not get in their way if they decide to do something. And they've got the systems and technology to do whatever they want. So it's a rising power, and rising powers are always interesting. But yeah, talking about Eaglin's article, she just hammered this budget. It's almost a Potemkin village. Let's see. It says the 2022 National Defense Strategy may reiterate familiar points, but the administration's budget request is only masquerading as robust. In reality, the military will continue to shrink and age under this program, and the promised vaunted future, if it ever arrives, will not be until after this team leaves office. Wow.
Yeah, she did not mince words, but that's good. We need, clear and direct communication, so to speak. Is the budgetary environment was always going to be a challenge this decade for a variety of reasons, but I don't think what a lot of people took into consideration is the impact of inflation, because we really haven't had to deal with an inflationary environment from a budgetary point of view in a decade. There's a lot of people who've lost, not just the, on both a personal and a national level, they've lost the ability to conceptualize that. It's like, I'm getting $100 for Christmas this year. You know, next year I'm going to get $105, but that $105 is only going to buy what last year $90 would have bought you. So you're not getting five more dollars. You're actually getting $10 less. That understanding that concept and being able to translate that into your planning, what you think you're going to be able to buy. That's why I always giggle with the 30-year shipbuilding plan. It's like, can we just call it a 3-year shipbuilding plan? Because I don't trust anything past. So I will look at FY 24, 25, 26, 27. You'll go two POM cycles and change. That might give you a view of what's actually going to happen. But anything beyond that in the quote out years, unquote, you can't plan. You can aspire to it. But I think a while ago I posted something on Twitter. It was the 2007 30-year shipbuilding plan. It's a parallel universe today's 2023 compared to what they thought 2023 would actually look like. And I think people need to take consideration of that when they go, well, you know, things are going to be kind of tough here for a few years, but it's going to be a much better in 2037. It don't work that way. And when you look at...
I think one of the things she points out in the article is that the amount of free money, I mean, money that is not already obligated in the defense budget is unbelievably small. Everybody thinks we have this huge defense budget, but when you look at the actual numbers, some of it's already committed, and some of it in areas where we probably shouldn't be spending money. I mean, she has a piece in there about, from somebody else quoting, you know, why are we bothering with medical research and stuff that really belongs in it under a different government entity. And but you know, there is this, it's just a wee bit of money available to have fun with, and it gets eaten by the fact that we have this spiraling inflation, which is killing us right now.
And that's right, there's some stuff in the defense budget that doesn't belong there, but that's the, you know, quarters in the couch cushion type of thing. Vice the money you have in the safe. And it's kind of nice. I'm not going to go full Blake Herzinger on us here, but I also like where she put the numbers out there. You know, the Navy does actually get the largest slice of the pie marginally, $203 billion. The Army gets $186 billion. The Air Force gets $185 billion. And if you want a larger Navy or you want a larger Air Force and you're going to have steady to slightly declining purchasing power budgets over the rest of the decade or whatever, that money is going to have to come from somewhere, which means you have to really do an almost baseline restructuring of our national strategy. You know, East of Suez type stuff to a certain extent. You know, what can we do? I know there, you know, Brian McGrath and stuff like that, he doesn't like have that conversation where you have your strategy meet your budget. You tell people what your strategy is and you get the budget to go get it. I appreciate that, and I wish it happened that way, but that may work in war. But in peace, when you have divided government like we do, it's not the environment where you can be making demands on the Hill where one party has a margin of 12 seats in one house and two seats in the other. It's really hard to push things. It changed things radically. So what do you do with that? Yeah, how many more billions could you get from the Army inside of our present structure? Probably not much. It's going to require a 100-pound head type of routine. And it's on, speaking of Brian, as a lot of listeners know, he was nominated along with Mackenzie Eaglin and a few other people to this Future of the Navy Commission that was supposed to be fully rounded out in May. And this is just an observational point of view. This is not a partisan comment. I'm not trying to make this partisan anyway. The Republicans have put their noms forward. The Democrats have not. So half of the committee hasn't even been named yet, and we're already 6 weeks behind the deadline to get it started. I'll let other people decide for themselves why that's taking place. Unfortunately, I think what that has done, and it was kind of excited when we had that opportunity to have the Future of the Navy Commission. Commissions have a limited utility historically, but they're nice to have because they're conversation starters. It would have been an opportunity for some really smart people. And the other two people that are nominated, whose names I can't pull off the top of my head, they're of equal quality of Mackenzie and Brian. And I'm sure the Democrats would nominate. I've seen a couple of names floated around, but you don't know until they're nominated, are going to be of equal quality folks. That would have been a great conversation starter to talk about what our Navy could be and how we could possibly find funding to do that. And having McKinsey there, who is one of the best minds on the defense budget of any stripe around, on that committee, I think would have that touch of budgetary realism to it. Hopefully we'll have those nominations and we'll see this commission come out sometime before the end of the decade. But again, it's another lost opportunity to have an intellectual discussion of what direction we need to go to. And for any of our Democrat friends out there on the Hill who may be listening, if y'all could help move that along, That'd be great. Y'all have some smart people on your side of the aisle that I know could really help us get a nice talking point coming out of that commission.
And once again, you know, we waste so much money in our government. And if you see the recent numbers that have come out and the amount of money that seems to be missing as a result of the COVID giveaways and things, you know, that it's just astonishing that we are nickel and diming our defense at a time when we have more threats than ever. I mean, the North Koreans just launched an ICBM that has the potential to reach the U.S. West Coast, you know, and their leadership is not exactly the most rational around, so unless they're looking for some kind of bribery scheme where we pay them not to blow us up, I wouldn't trust them too much at this point. But it, you know, we have these other issues. You got to do something. So
yeah, the Hermit Kingdom was kind of cute and fun to make interesting comments about from a distance, but insular societies like that are, it really is degenerated into almost a medieval absolute monarchy from the Kim family. But you're right. If they have that ability, who knows what paranoid thought might come into some very imperfect human being, like we're all imperfect. And there's nobody in their structure that is going to say no to the supreme leader. Is one Tuesday afternoon, you've got four or five missiles for reasons, who knows, heading out on the Great Circle Route on Europe, and you really hope those facilities we have in Alaska work. You know, what do you do with that? A modern, you know, the bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those are tactical nukes almost compared to what even the North Koreans can build today. And that's one of those nightmare scenarios you don't like to think about, but you know, I'm glad you brought it up because it's no longer a theoretical capability. Even if they only have four or five, you know, you can say what you want to about the Russians or the Chinese or the Indians or the Pakistanis or the Israelis or the French or the British, but they have pretty good command and control and checks and balances on their systems. I don't think the North Koreans, they have developed over the course of decades a civil society that nobody has really seen since the, at best, the late Middle Ages. It's not a pleasant thought. I don't know how you control those things or whether you even have much indications and warnings. Besides, I believe they're all liquid-fueled, and you would get some indications that they might be getting ready for a launch, but you know, what's our OODA loop to stop them from launching? I don't think it's that tight or war gamed out enough that they would launch and then we would know.
Well, those Aegis SM-6 ships better be on alert all the time now in that area. So.
Yeah. Well, I guess we've used up our hour and change on a very positive, strange, loving point. At least they don't have a doomsday weapon.
Or do they?
Oh, well, we're on the East Coast, you know. You know, the San Andreas fault line gets hit by 100 megatons. I'm not sure what that'll do to it.
Oh, I think there's been that. I think wasn't there a James Bond movie about that? I can't remember. Yeah.
Well, hey, yeah. My illustrious wife made the fun comment I've heard other people make as well. It's like, how do we find ourselves in the third decade of the 21st century and these comical Bond villains actually exist? We have all these players. It's like, you know, you have a good point that we do have some people out there who kind of like a Bond villain that we used to laugh about in 1978, but we don't have any orbiting space stations yet, but our
really?
Sharks of
lasers. Really? I thought the Chinese had put one up of their, or getting ready to put up their own orbiting space station. You know, I think we should ban fiction writers from coming up with these great ideas to give to bad guys.
We're talking about you, Claude.
Exactly.
No, I don't know where you're sitting, but Claude listens to a lot of our mid-rats, and maybe I think he might be with us live, staying out of the heat in Annapolis. But it's like the running joke whenever Claude writes a novel, that, okay, then that's a part of the world we need to look at. Because he started with Yemen, right, when all that kicked off. And then we had the issues with Sri Lanka. And with his latest novel as well, if people haven't read it yet, you can find a click from last week's episode. We have a link to all of Claude's novels. And just a reminder, if you didn't check it, go to last week's show. And all the books that we mentioned, you can go to the show page don't go to Blog Talk. Go to Spreaker or iTunes or anything that gets the podcast feed. And it has all links to all the books that we recommended for you to absorb your summer. And you'll find Claude's books there as well.
I guess we're saying goodbye then.
I think so. Well, hey.
Okay.
Everybody, we appreciate y'all coming in. We had a good show in the chat room today. We had about 8 people there. We appreciate y'all coming along today. And we will have a show next week, but then we're taking the 30th off. And then before you know it, it'll be August. So thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. And until next week, hope y'all have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.